From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Randy Newman joins us at the piano for some music and conversation. Also, carrying on the Disney tradition, we talk with the chairman of the Walt Disney Studios, Jeffrey Katzenberg, about reviving the art of animated musical films. He's overseen the production of The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and the new Aladdin. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by two performers with sexy public personas, Madonna and Prince. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bill Clinton and Democratic congressional leaders pledged today to end what they called the Cold War between the White House and Capitol Hill. The Democrats appeared together today in Little Rock after a dinner meeting last night to discuss legislative priorities. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Governor Clinton and Senator Al Gore, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, House Speaker Tom Foley, and House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt all told reporters today in Little Rock that they intend to make government work again. All five men are veteran lawmakers. The difference this year, they say, is that Democrats, for the first time in over a decade, will control both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. "I don't want a continuation of the Cold War," Governor Clinton said today, referring to the legislative impasse characteristic of the last few years. Congressman Gephardt and the others all made similar statements.
"Gridlock is over, and cooperation and teamwork have begun."
In the spirit of cooperation, Governor Clinton has backed down on an earlier proposal to reduce congressional staff by the same amount that he intends to pare down the White House. Despite reports to the contrary, however, he said he does intend to make good on his pledge to reduce the tax burden on the middle class. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Little Rock.
Clinton also said today that he'd consider a candidate for Secretary of Defense even if that person disagreed with him on allowing homosexuals to serve in the military. The issue came up at today's news conference when Clinton was asked if he were still considering Senator Sam Nunn for the defense post. Nunn, who's chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, is considered to rank high on the list of possible choices for defense secretary. He's also reacted coolly to Clinton's proposal to lift the military's ban on homosexuals. Clinton said today that he doesn't expect his friends or supporters to agree with him on every issue. An elderly Palestinian man was killed and eight other Arabs injured when a hand grenade was thrown into the Arab market of Jerusalem's Old City. An extremist Jewish organization claimed responsibility. From Jerusalem, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The hand grenade was apparently thrown from the roof of a building in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem, an area where both Jews and Arabs live. The grenade exploded in the middle of the quarter's crowded meat market, killing the Palestinian stall owner and injuring eight shoppers. An anonymous caller from the extremist Kach movement called a journalist and claimed responsibility. He said the movement carried out the attack to commemorate the assassination of their leader, Rabbi Meir Kahane, 2 years ago. Police say they're investigating all possibilities, including that it was thrown by a Jew. There are currently no suspects in custody. Police have sent reinforcements to both the Muslim quarter and the neighboring Jewish quarter, fearing revenge attacks by Arabs on Jews. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Dow Industrials lost 27 points today to close at 3,205. This is NPR. Germany appears to be closer to changing its constitution in a way that would limit the right of asylum that's offered to foreign refugees. The main opposition party, the Social Democrats, agreed today to approve a plan that would add restrictions to the asylum law. The change was approved at a party congress, apparently in hopes of defusing far more restrictive measures that are being proposed by the radical right. More than 450,000 people are expected to apply for asylum in Germany this year. A new survey released today by the Anti-Defamation League says 20% of Americans hold strongly anti-Semitic views. That figure is down from 29% in a 1964 study. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
The survey conducted by Martilla and Kiley of Boston polled 1,100 adults. It divides Americans into three categories: not anti-Semitic, middle ground people, and most anti-Semitic, based on answers to 11 questions. For example, do you believe that Jews are more willing than others to use shady practices? The survey found that 39% of Americans were virtually free of anti-Semitic attitudes, another 41% were reasonably unprejudiced, and 20%, those who agreed with at least six of the 11 stereotypes, were the most anti-Semitic. In general, older Americans, blue-collar workers, and blacks held the most anti-Semitic attitudes. Blacks were twice as likely as whites to hold such views. The poll found a high correlation between anti-Semitism, racism, and xenophobia. And while one in three Americans believes Jews have too much power and increase, nearly half the public believes whites in general have too much power. I'm Margo Adler in New York.
Britain said today that it's turned down almost all of a group of Bosnian refugees who've been seeking asylum. A government spokesman said that entry visas will be given to only six of the 183 refugees who've applied. The refugee group has been stranded for 6 days on the border between Slovenia and Austria, waiting for a decision. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A Fresh Air high point of 1988 was an interview with Randy Newman, the singer-songwriter and pianist. All of us hoped that someday he'd join us again at the piano in our studio. We were delighted when he accepted our invitation to do that last week before a concert date here in Philadelphia. Some of Randy Newman's best-known songs are Short People, Simon Smith and the Amazing Dancing Bear, I Think It's Gonna Rain Today, Political Science, Sail Away, Baltimore, I Love L.A., and Lonely at the Top. He's also written several film scores. Randy Newman started recording in the late 60s. His latest album, Land of Dreams, came out in 1988. I asked what he's been up to since then.
I've taken time off and actually done nothing, but this time I was working. I did Parenthood and Avalon and Awakenings. And I've been working for about a year and a half on a show for Broadway, hopefully, based on Faust, and an album which I'm going to make with... In my version of Faust, you know, the old story where the Lord and the devil make a wager about whether man is redeemable. In my version, they make the same wager, but it's a kid who goes to Notre Dame in South Bend. And James Taylor's going to play the Lord, and I'm going to do the devil on this album, and Don Henley will be Faust. So, you know, it's on the geriatric side, but I don't know any young people. I'd ask the kid from Nirvana to play. Linda Ronstadt's going to be Margaret, and Bonnie Raitt, Martha, her friend, and Elton John's plays this sort of embittered British angel who does a song.
When do you expect the show is going to be
performed? I have no idea.
Right.
No idea. As a matter of fact, that's why I'm making an album. You know, I've got all these people who've agreed to do it, and I haven't had... done anything except the soundtracks, you know, for too long. I mean, I'd like to do more in these final twilight 20 years of my life than in the last 20 years. I'm not happy with the amount of work I've done.
Well, you usually have a few years between records.
Yeah, but there's no excuse for it. No excuse for it. And my work habits are better now. You know, I'm not... I used to, you know, lie out by the pool in the morning and send my kids off, you know, to school and say, you know, work hard, you know, come on, you know, do well in school. I was like sitting around, you know, talking to the pool man half the day. So, I mean, it was a bad example.
Well, you had...
They turned out all right.
You had Epstein-Barr for a while, too.
Yeah, I did.
The disease where you have, like, no energy months and years. You're right,
yeah.
And you can't get a diagnosis. But that's all behind you.
Yeah. Good. So it went away like it came. Just, it was gone. It was bad. Every once in a while, I have a day where I get up and, you know, my heart rate would, like, be 40 beats faster standing up than it was lying down. It was just hard to go from here to there. I feel very sorry for anyone who has it.
So when you haven't had a new album in a few years and people don't know that you're working on a musical, do some people wonder, well, where is he? I think that's
either
something...
They wonder where is he, and then it's who is he? It isn't like the mystique builds up, you know, like Dylan with his motorcycle accident. It's like, oh, who? You know, so it doesn't work for me to, like, I'll stay away for a while. I've been overexposed.
Let me ask you to do one of your older songs for us, a song that I think that most of our listeners will know. Would you do Political Science for
us?
We know it as Let's Drop the Big One.
And yeah, hopefully. It's never been out of date since I wrote it, but maybe it is now.
Yeah.
Nah, there's a trade war. No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded, Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia. Don't wanna hurt no kangaroo. Build an all-American amusement park there. They got surfing too. Boom goes London and boom Paris. More room for you and more room for me. In every city, the whole world round, we'll just be another American town. Oh, how peaceful it will be. We'll set everybody free. You wear a Japanese kimono, babe. It'll be Italian shoes for me. They all hate us anyhow. So let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one now.
What a wonderful song.
Thank you.
How did you write that?
I don't know. I think it came fairly quickly. I don't remember the circumstances. Just, you know, there's always been that. This is that sort of xenophobia that's been in the country, that's always been here, always will be, you know, sort of cubed. I mean, almost no one is this nuts anymore, but few people are.
Have you developed a separate sound for accompanying yourself at the piano than you'd use if you were just sitting at the piano alone to play? Do you think of yourself as having a sound that you use when you're singing?
A pianistic sound?
Yeah. I mean, I think of you as having one, but I couldn't explain
it. I don't
it.
Think of it, but I probably just adjust to what I'm doing, yeah. I have a style of playing, I think, that I can tell it's me, if only because I can't keep time.
Is there a certain kind of left hand that you think of as you or something?
Oh, you know, my son does this imitation of me. You know, without hitting, he goes, you know, it's a, this. I'm very fond of shuffles. I have been all my life. It seems to be my natural mode of expression. My mother was from New Orleans. I don't know whether that has anything to do with it. But, you know, Blue Monday. I hate Blue Monday. Got to work like a slave all day. I mean, that's the stuff I love. And people don't tend to like shuffles that much, you know, and drummers hate them. But I've written more than I should have, you know. So maybe there's something to my left hand.
So when you first got access to a piano, when you were trying to do things that you heard?
As a kid?
Yeah, as a kid.
I never tried to do things I heard. I just played out of the little, you know, the Thompson from a Wigwam book at the party. That was getting complicated there. But I never, there was music in my family. And I remember when I was about six, all of a sudden, there was like a piano in my room, you know, just in case I was Mozart. I think they wanted to have this thing looming, an upright, Hoffman upright, looming over me. My dad was a doctor, but he loved show business, you know, And before he went in the Army, he went on that Hollywood Caravan tour. One of my uncles conducted that thing during the war, and he was a doctor on that, and I guess he never got over it. But, I mean, I think he wanted me to be a musician, though he never admitted it. I mean, what was the piano doing there, you know?
Right.
I didn't know what to do with it.
So did you impress them with your musical skill early on?
Yeah, I did with my ear. You know, they could play a record, and I would name them what it was when I was very young, apparently.
So if you started off playing all these, you know, piano for beginner type
sure.
books, how did you start to learn rock and roll? Did you just pick it up from records? Could you?
I think I did when I was, started 15, 16. A friend of mine suggested, you know, why don't you try and write some songs? His father was in the record business, so I did. And then a publisher signed me up. But it isn't like you'll hear stories. I work with Jeff Lynn on the last record, who was with ELO, and a lot of guys listened to a record. They just, it did something to them. It clicked some kind of switch in them where they'd listen and copy the riffs on everything. I never did it. I was pushed kicking and screaming the whole way, it seems like, into music in some kind of ways. Even when I was in college and people would be all, they'd say, oh, did you hear Shostakovich's 11th Symphony? Or I don't know what it was then, about 11 maybe. And I, you know, I hadn't heard, but I was better than everybody at composition classes and stuff like that. Worse at, you know, sight singing and things like that. But I was good at it. I had talent for it.
Were lessons forced on you?
No, but I never always felt I wasn't practicing enough, and I wasn't. I there's no doubt that I have some talent for it. And I probably have developed some of it too. I know that sounds odd, but
what was the first kind of stuff you started writing at the piano for yourself?
The first thing I wrote was like a summer song. I was 16, 17. They tell me it's summer. It went, but I know it's a lie. Summer's for laughing. All I do is cry. Jeez, I don't know whose key this was. But anyway, it was recorded by the Fleetwoods. Man, they tell me it's summer. But I know it's a lie. Cause summer's for laughing. All I do is cry. Things like that, you know, not really bad, but just vapid.
Randy Newman is with us. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer, songwriter, and pianist Randy Newman. Let me ask you to do another song.
Absolutely.
Is there one you particularly like to do, or Dixie Flyer, or mm-hmm. Emotional Girl, or?
I'll do Emotional Girl. She's a real emotional girl. She wears her heart on her sleeve. Every little thing you tell her, she'll believe. She really will. She even cries in her sleep. I've heard her many times before. Never had a girl who loved me half as much as this girl loves me. It's real emotional. For 18 years she lived at home. She was daddy's little girl. that he helped to move out on home. She met a boy, he broke her heart. Now she lives alone. She's very, very careful. Yes, she is. She's a real emotional girl. She lives down deep inside herself. She turns on easy, it's like a hurricane. You would not believe it. Gotta hold on tight to her. She's a real emotional girl.
Is that song about somebody? I mean, somebody you know?
It's about a bad guy, I think. You know, I mean, it sort of slips by as a love song, but he shouldn't be telling anyone what he knows about this girl, in my opinion. But I let it go. What a beautiful love song. I don't think so. I think he shouldn't say, you know, she turns on easy like a hurricane to anyone else. I've seen her cry in her sleep. What business is that of anybody's? I guess I just can't help myself. I sometimes play the thing from Parenthood, you know, in the show I do. And it's so atypical of my work. It's so jolly. But my doing it, it sounds evil, you know, even somehow.
Well, the song from Parenthood, I'd Love to See You Smile.
Yeah.
Wasn't that used for a commercial?
Yeah.
A Colgate. Camera or something?
Colgate? For toothpaste.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, that's
I agonized over that for about half a minute.
Well,
I didn't know what to do.
You figured it was worth the money.
It is worth the money, and it wasn't a song that has any sacred, you know, I was trying to sell the movie.
Right.
And that was my job.
It's almost as if it's easier for you to write songs in the character of people who you really don't like.
Oh, I got some sympathy for every one of them. But basically that's sort of true. I wouldn't say I dislike, but I'm more interested in that. No one else does it. I wrote love songs, you know, when I was a kid, but I don't write many now.
Why not?
Well, there's enough of them, and maybe they're harder. You know, maybe I'm shy. I don't know. I'd write one for another person, but I wouldn't necessarily be interested in it for me. It depends. A song like Marie that's in character, I would. It's an odd kind of, probably some sort of psychiatric problem.
Yeah, right. I was going to suggest that.
No, but I figure, I've always said that, you know, if a short story writer or a novelist or a guy in a movie has the latitude not to be me, well, I mean, why can't I be? And I want to say something else.
Can I ask you to do a chorus of Lonely at the Top?
Sure.
I just think that's one of your really kind of fun songs.
I've been around the world. I've had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name, but it's just a crazy game. Oh, it's lonely at the top. You know what I was noticing since you're sitting right here and I'm singing?
Yeah.
How hard it must have been, unless you're an actor in movies, you know, I was trying to look at you and sing. It's murder. It would be murder to listen, too, you know. I love you, I'll always love you. Jesus Christ.
It's really embarrassing to
I couldn't do it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you don't know what to do. I don't know what to
exactly,
do.
Exactly, exactly. So are you averting your eyes?
Oh, very much so. I'm afraid. As a matter of fact, I'm glad I can't see audiences. You know, when you do TV, they're lit up. So, you know, you're playing a lot on Letterman or Saturday Night Live, and you can see the people, and, you know, you see people talking to each other. I'm afraid to look.
Now, I remember from the last interview we did that you wrote that for Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, I did. And I thought it really would have been kind of hip if he did that.
Yeah.
And I played it for Streisand, but she said, well, people would believe it. You know, if she sung that, maybe she's right.
Do people believe it about you? Do they think that you're singing?
It depends. Some towns. You know, I used to play it in Philadelphia, strangely enough, where we are, and they wouldn't laugh. They'd think I was at the time, even if there were 12 people in the audience, you know, at a club.
You know, in talking about how you don't usually write the kind of, like, emotional, sincere song, like your song Dixie Flyer is, it's a very personal song, but by the end of it, you're talking about kind of, anti-Semitism in a way.
Yeah. A lot of my songs I hope are moving. You know, it's just... I don't know. I had someone ask me, you know, are you going to start writing more personally like Dixie Flyer is now? And I said, no, I don't think so. I wanted to see if I could do something like that. But, I mean, I don't think my stuff is necessarily deficient in emotion because it's, I'm not the first person in the eye, you know. So I refute your argument. And shoot it down in flames and once again triumph to go on to further triumphs in cities around the country. Not a hard, mean man, but a gentle, understanding man who wishes his private life to remain. I mean, here's what I think. I think you could tell more about me, what I'd be like, just making a guess, coming in the studio and never seen me before. Than you could about some of these people who are writing about, well, we made love in the meadow, and oh, I'm going there, over there, and I love you, I'll always love you. I mean, some of those guys are monsters, believe me.
I believe you.
I mean, but you could guess. You'd be pretty right about what I'd be like. I bet you could have guessed, maybe, that I wasn't the ogre that some have painted me. I rest my case. Innocent. But,
I really regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you so much, Randy Newman, for coming.
Pleasure.
It's just been wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
It's been good to be here.
Randy Newman is on tour. He performs tonight in Houston, tomorrow in Austin, Friday in San Francisco, and Saturday in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and this is from Randy Newman's 1988 album, Land of Dreams.
I was born right here. Dad was a captain in the army, fighting the Germans in Sicily. My poor little mama didn't know a soul in L.A. She went down to the Union Station, made our getaway.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, reviving the animated musical. We talk with Jeffrey Katzenberg, the chairman of the Disney Studios. He oversaw the production of The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin, the new animated film. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by two stars with sex on their minds, Madonna and Prince. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Arthur Dunkel, head of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT, which oversees the application of world trade rules, met in Washington today with U.S. officials. He is hoping to head off a trade war between the United States and Europe and salvage endangered world trade talks. NPR's John Edstey reports.
There were no breakthroughs during talks between Dunkel and U.S. trade officials today. The GATT Director General is trying to diffuse tension between the United States and the European community over EC subsidies to its oilseed farmers. The GATT has ruled the subsidies are unfairly depriving U.S. farmers of export markets, and the U.S. is poised to respond with trade sanctions. The oilseed dispute is threatening the six-year effort to rewrite world trade rules under the GATT. Today in Brussels, EC officials reiterated a desire to settle the quarrel, but friction between France and other EC nations, which is making an agreement difficult, continued today. The French reportedly suggested the EC is capitulating to U.S. demands, but the EC's chief negotiator, Ray McSherry, rejected the criticism as rubbish and nonsense. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
In London, British Prime Minister John Major has taken steps to defuse a growing political controversy over Britain's sale of arms to Iraq in the years before the Persian Gulf War. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The Prime Minister announced he was widening the scope of the judicial inquiry into Iraqi arms sales. The inquiry was set up last week after three executives of British arms manufacturer Matrix Churchill were acquitted of selling embargoed defense equipment to Saddam Hussein. It turned out one of the men was actually working for the British security services. Major said the inquiry would look at all aspects of British arms sales to Iraq, including the British role in helping Saddam Hussein build the supergun. Despite Major's maneuver, Britain's opposition political parties kept up the pressure on the Prime Minister. The Labour Party's trade spokesman, Robin Cook, made public nine documents that had previously been kept secret. He claimed they showed Major must have known about Matrix Churchill trade with Iraq in 1990, something the Prime Minister consistently denies. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Both sides in the Middle Eastern peace talks currently underway in Washington are accusing each other of setting up roadblocks to a solution. Syria has accused Israel of trying to cancel overtures to peace. Israeli Prime Minister Rabin is quoted in the Washington Post as accusing Syria of undermining the talks by allowing guerrilla attacks in southern Lebanon. This latest round of talks is expected to end this week without any apparent progress. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 27 points to close at 3,205.74 on volume of more than 174 million shares. This is NPR News. Bill Clinton predicts a new period of cooperation in Washington after a dozen years of divided government. After meeting in Little Rock with House and Senate leaders, Clinton said that the White House and Congress have ended their own Cold War and will now work on getting the economy moving again. Clinton also called plans by transition chairman Vernon Jordan to take a leave of absence from his law firm and corporate boards a good gesture. But Clinton did not say that he believes other transition leaders should do the same. A majority of parents read to their children every day. But a new study indicates that as children grow older, parents stop reading with them, and television replaces books. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
6 out of every 10 parents say reading is one of the most important, if not the most important, skill children should develop. In fact, 42% of parents with children ages 1 to 10 say their kids spend a lot more time with books than watching television. Not long after these children turn 11, though, reading at home stops. And only 13% of parents with kids between 9 and 14 years of age said they read with their children. The study, commissioned by the American Federation of Teachers with money from the Chrysler Corporation, found that parents give up reading with their children when they sense that their son or daughter is reading independently. A parent's job as a teacher, the report says, isn't over at that point. It simply changes. Experts say reading ability is still one of the most important predictors of school success. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
Both the White House and the State Department have refused comment on a charge by a fired State Department official that it was the White House that wanted a search of Bill Clinton's passport files. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher turned aside all questions about the controversy today, saying that a probe by the Inspector General will be made public this Wednesday. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Many of us grew up wondering what we'd ask for if we had three wishes. The idea of three wishes comes from an Arabian fairy tale about a street urchin named Aladdin who finds a magic lamp with a genie inside. If my guest Jeffrey Katzenberg had three wishes, one would be that the new Disney animated feature Aladdin is a big success. Katzenberg is the chairman of the Disney Studios. He oversaw the production of Aladdin and Disney's other recent animated musical features, The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. He was formerly an executive at Paramount. Aladdin has songs by the team of composer Alan Menken and lyricist Howard Ashman, who also wrote the songs for The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. But Ashman died before Aladdin was completed. Lyricist Tim Rice worked on the remaining songs. Here's one of the Menken Ashman songs, sung by Robin Williams, who does the voice of the genie.
Hey, clear the way in the old bazaar.
Hey, you!
Let us through, it's a bright new star. Oh, come be the first on your block to meet his eye. Make way, here he comes, ring bells and the drum. Are you gonna love this sky? Prince Ali, fabulous he, Ali Ababa. Genuflect, show some respect down on one knee. Now try your best to stay calm, brush up your Sunday salon, then come and meet his spectacular coterie. Prince Ali, mighty is he, Ali Ababa. Strong as 10 regular men, definitely.
He faced the galloping hordes,
100 bad guys with swords.
Who sent those goons to their lords?
Why, Prince Ali!
He's got 75 golden pants.
Don't they look lovely, June?
Purple peacocks, he's got 53.
Fabulous, Harry, I love the feathers. When it
comes to... One of the things I especially like about these recent animated films is that they seem to be carrying on the tradition of Broadway music in a way that Broadway isn't necessarily carrying it on itself. In terms of new songs. Whose idea was it to make these recent animation films musicals?
Walt Disney's.
Well, but you didn't have to go in that direction in the new ones.
Well, I tell you, Terry, the more we've learned about our heritage and the values that sort of the template that Walt Disney laid down, the more we've come to appreciate just how strong and how successful sort of those tentpole elements are. And the fact is that in the late 70s and early 80s, these movies stopped being musicals, which was not true of the original Disney films. And so we really did set out to, follow in the footsteps of Walt Disney himself. There is no question that Howard Ashman and Alan Menken were the architects, were the guardian angels who really kind of showed us a path. They really taught us how to make our movies sing again.
Howard Ashman, who was the lyricist on Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid and wrote lyrics to some of the songs on and the new movie Aladdin, died of AIDS. How did you find out that he was sick and what...
Howard is someone who had become a very close personal friend beyond just the working relationship, and came to me early on and said, I'm going to tell you something and take you into my confidence, and then tell you I'm going to ask something of you, which, you know, I hope you can help me with. So he told me that he was sick and said that more than anything else, he wanted to finish his work, and asked that beyond anything, money, anything, credit, he wanted the help that we could give him in seeing Beauty and the Beast and as much of the work in Aladdin through to completion as he could. And as Howard really deteriorated over a 6-9 month period of time, which was heartbreaking, at every turn, we tried to give him the means to do his work. And what I mean by that is that he lost the power to walk. We found a way to transport him around. He lost his vocal cords. We found someone who would, you know, be able to be by his bedside and you know, who he could whisper to and could carry on could communicate for him. In the very end, he lost his eyesight. I mean, it was just a horrible, horrible, horrible experience. And all the way through it, he had this passion to see this movie through, to see Beauty and the Beast through to completion. And literally, a week after showing the sort of rough work in progress pieces to an extraordinary reaction here in New York, you know, which just brought incredible joy to him, he let go.
You mean he died after one of these screenings?
Well, a week after we really first sort of shared it with people outside of our little group of people making the movie.
What was it like for you when he was sick and he would be playing works in progress for you? Say you didn't like something he was working on. You felt close to him. He wasn't well. Did you have the heart to tell him you didn't like something if you didn't like it?
We enjoyed a wonderful collaboration. Howard was as tough an artist as I've ever come across, as opinionated, strong-willed, dogmatic, and I guess what I'd have to say to you in the end, Terry, is right. Whatever the process is, it was, it was wonderful for both of us, and I think produced, some extraordinary work. And I guess what I would say is that I got out of Howard's way.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Katzenberg, the chairman of Disney Studios, and Disney's new animated feature film, Aladdin, has just been released. It will be opening nationally soon. It's already opened in a couple of cities. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Katzenberg, the chair of Disney Studios. Have you, when you got to Disney, did you consciously set out to expand the animation part of the studio?
Well, you've got to go back and start with the fact that the person that brought Michael Eisner and Frank Wells and myself to the Walt Disney Studio was Roy Disney, who is Walt's nephew. And the very first thing that Roy did when we arrived at Disney is literally took us by the hand down to the animation building and said to us, this must be your first priority. It will take a very long time to rebuild this organization. At the time we arrived, there were 160 artists working there. They had just finished the Black Cauldron, which for all its ambition was a solid miss. And the place had become very dogmatic and it had lost its spirit and it lost its, it had lost, it wandered so off its track, that it just really needed to be rebuilt from the ground floor up. And Roy was the one who said, you know, more than anything else, you know, more than whatever you do at Touchstone or in the television business or any of those things, this is the first priority. And, you know, with that wisdom, you know, we went about doing it. Today there are 700 artists, you know, that are between California and our studio down in Florida. And we've actually, this is the fifth movie in 5 years, which was always a dream of Walt's. Walt always wanted to build an organization that was large enough and deep enough that there could always be three or four movies in various stages of production at any one time, because they do take 4 years to make still. And so, as I say, you know, Roy, really more than anyone else, is the sort of architect of the renaissance of animation at Disney.
You've spoken out about movies costing too much and about too much of a focus on the blockbuster. Do you think that that's changing? Have you tried to change it at Disney?
Well, we have changed it at Disney. Whether others are changing or not is, I don't know, it's hard to tell. I think, you know, it is different personalities run, you know, their movie business differently. And you know, Warner Brothers, who makes very big, you know, sort of exciting action movies, is having a fantastic year. They do it very, very well. I can tell you we're no good at it. You know, they make a movie like Under Siege or Passenger 57 or Lethal Weapon 3 or, you know, Batman 2. They've had an unbelievable year. They make these sort of big, giant event, you know, boys with toys movies. Mm-hmm. And they have a great deal of success with it. I can tell you we're neither, you know, we're not any good at making them. And the few times we have, we haven't had a lot of success doing it. So I can't say that our way is right and theirs is wrong or vice versa in it. We're tackling the business on a way that, you know, seems to work for us. It's comfortable for us. It's a different kind of movie.
What kind of, is there a different kind of pressure on you as, you know, as the head of the studio when you're working on one of these multi-gazillion dollar pictures as opposed to, you know, an expensive but comparatively modest-sized picture? I mean, because it's really sink or swim when you're dealing with the blockbuster. Either you're going to make a fortune or you're going to make a small fortune, and that's not going to be enough.
I guess, again, it's very much reflective of the personalities. For me,
yeah,
I don't sleep at night.
with which?
With making those big movies,
yeah,
where there's so much at stake.
Yeah.
It goes into life is too short. It's not worth it. And I'm not even that good at it, so I've stopped trying.
When you're overseeing a film that's in production, do you like to have that film tested before test audiences? And then, you know, then the audiences rate it, and then you could look at their feedback and decide whether the ending needs to be changed or whether something needs to be changed.
Well, I love seeing movies play with audiences, and I think it's invaluable, but I think the process has become so corruptive. I really more and more have discouraged, you know, filmmakers from doing anything other than putting their movie in front of audiences, but preview cards. And I refuse to actually even listen to what they call focus groups now. You know, they have these groups after the movie is over, 20 or 30 people that sit and sort of pick it apart and become instantaneous critics of it. I just find it's misleading, and I think it you can't make movies by committees that way, by testing, by researching. They have to be the vision of a, you know, of somebody with creative leadership, and, you know, be it the director or the producer or, you know, even a studio executive in it. So I think that process really has gone too far.
Jeffrey Katzenberg is the chair of the Disney Studios. Aladdin opens nationally Wednesday, November 25th. Here's another Menken and Ashman song from Aladdin.
Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam, where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. When the wind's from the east and the sun's from the west and the sand in the glass is right, come on down, stop on by, hop a carpet and fly to another Arabian night. Arabian nights, like Arabian days. More often than not, are hotter than hot in a lot of good ways. Arabian nights, with Arabian moons. A fool off his guard could fall and fall hard out there on the dune.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have more news on who exactly ordered whom to look into Bill Clinton's passport file in the National Archives, the indictment of police in Detroit and the beating death of Malice Green, two white policemen charged with murder in the beating of Mr. Green, and also a special report today from NPR's Daniel Zwerdling on Botswana and why that southern African country, when so many others have been taken over by dictators over the years, has remained an outpost of democracy in that area. The answer has a great deal to do with the country's wealth from diamonds.
Thanks, Robert. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to some of the season's biggest pop music releases and has this roundup review.
So far, this season hasn't been a good one for big-name acts. The new collection from R.E.M., Automatic for the People, is so wan and dispirited that I've decided not to depress you with it. Garth Brooks is a true pop culture breakthrough, a country music liberal with mass appeal, but his new album, The Chase, is bloated with the self-importance of that breakthrough. As for Prince, he's up to his old tricks, which is both good news and bad.
Ooh.
In a word or two, what you I wanna do. No, not your body and mind, you fool. Come here, baby. Yeah.
You sexy motherfucker.
We're all alone in a villa on the Riviera. Got some friends on the south side in case you cared. Out of all of your friends, I wanna be the closest. That's why I tell you things so you'll be the mostest. When it comes to life, to be this man's wife, you got to be well educated on the subject of fights. I mean the prevention of, in other words, it's R.E.M. meaning of this thing called love. Are you up on this? If so, then you can get up off a hug and a kiss. Come here, babe. Yeah.
You sexy motherfucker.
Come here, babe. Yeah.
You sexy mother.
I can't tell you the name of Prince's new album on the radio, not because it's obscene, but because the title is a visual image, a little graphic design squiggle that mingles the symbols for male and female. The theme of the album is also all about male and female mingling, but by now, Prince's sex talk has become merely smutty, not sensuous. He's the only dirty old man I know who still looks like a wood nymph. There's a great deal of sophisticated music on this collection, an ambitious suite of long compositions, each of which combines pop, funk, and jazz into its swooping, diving melodies. But its technique is everything. It's as if Prince realized that we find his Baroque eroticism silly, not sexy, and he has very little else to talk about. The result is at once his most accomplished album and his most anonymous. So anonymous that he apparently feels he has to keep telling us who he is.
Sound like
Any roundup of big fall releases must include the severely overhyped Madonna. Now, I admire Madonna a lot. I think she's manipulated her image and the media in a witty way for a decade now. But with her latest multimedia assault, her book Sex and her new album Erotica, Madonna has, I think, miscalculated big time. There isn't a trace of wit or playfulness in the grim, porno-baiting pictures in Sex, and neither is there any redeeming irony in the earnest, sentimental music that dominates Erotica. The album is by no means a waste of time. It features some pretty ballads and a few interesting returns to her early period of chirpy-voiced disco music. I suspect that both Sex and Erotica sprang from quite high-minded impulses, that Madonna has been profoundly shaken by the AIDS epidemic and infuriated by the anti-sex self-righteousness that the plague has inspired among conservatives. Her book and album are a counterattack. The book is intended to shock her enemies. The record wants to comfort her afflicted allies. But Madonna's heated emotions have gotten the better of her usually cool head, and I'm sorry to say that neither of these projects does its job very well.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audie Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Joyce Lieberman. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Caine says a film actor's most important assets are his eyes and his voice. Caine has one of the most distinctive voices in the business. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Caine shows us how he changed his throaty Cockney accent and learned to use his voice to reveal the personality of the character he's playing. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.